originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Jude Feld.
Good evening, everyone, wherever you may be. Trainer Talk is on the air. This broadcast, sponsored by Fasig Tipton, is the show trainers listen to. This is Jude Feld, and I'm in our Jimmy John's of Lexington studio with my co-host and brother, Bloodstock Agent Deluxe, Bob Feld. And we are delighted to spend the next hour with you and our special guest. Tonight, our trainer is just beginning his career. So, Bob, we're going to be able to say we knew him when.
Yep.
And he's so new, he hasn't even run a horse yet.
Fresh.
Welcome to Trainer Talk, Kent Sweezy.
Thanks very much, guys. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's cool. We like to have the young trainers on, so when people see their names in the program, they go, "Oh, I heard that guy on Trainer Talk." So
exactly.
Let's go back to the start. Roughly 31 years ago, you were born into a family of talented horsemen. Your parents, Kathy and Wayne Sweezy, both significant. Involved in our sport. Were you a barn rat growing up?
I was kind of a farm rat, actually. Most kids, when they get grounded or get in trouble, they go sit in timeout or they have to go to their room. I was put on a weed eater, or I was mucking stalls from an early age. So it was good to get that good foundation in. And I did everything from foaling to working with the stallions and the sales. That's actually how I met Bob Feld. And it was great. It was good. I grew up on Darby Dan, actually. My dad was a manager at Darby Dan for 15 so years. So
if that was a situation, you must be the master of a weed eater right now, huh?
I'm one of the best out there. Yeah, I'd say I'm one of the best out there.
Well, it's
say, if you ask somebody to do a job, you better be able to do it better yourself. And I can actually say that mucking stalls and weed eating, I'm right up there with the best of them.
There you go. You could have been good in prison, it sounds like.
No comment.
Well, when did you actually start like working on the farm? Were you really young?
Yeah, my parents were divorced, so my mom lived in Louisville. We moved to Louisville when I was in the second grade, and so I would come to the farms every summer, every weekend, every spring break. I didn't get a chance to play the baseball and football like everybody else did, but I'm happy to say now that I learned a lot on the farm. And I probably started out, I'd say, when I was 10 years old, just messing around, going with the vet, things like that, with my dad, and learning all the reproductive stuff. And then I think when I was maybe 13, my dad finally let me properly groom a filly for the sales. And when you're on the farm, it's not quite like the racetrack. It's sort of a team thing. Everybody just pitches in and gets the job done. But he gave me a Chris S filly to rub, and she was going to Saratoga, so I had all summer long to rub on her. And so she looked great, did all that, and taught her to walk really nice, and I was showing her all the time. And we get the catalog out, and she's the second horse cataloged in the book. And you know how that goes. Usually people say, oh, it's bad luck, or the first horse in the ring, this and that. So they ended up scratching the hip number one. So she actually was the first horse in the ring, and she lit the board up at $900,000. And so she turned out to be a nice stakes filly called Love and Kiss S. And that was the first. That was my first horse that I kind of did the whole deal with. And I thought it was great. And I'd come back every summer, and I sort of moved up, and I became sort of a yearling foreman. And then I took a year off from school, and I was kind of like the broodmare manager, assistant broodmare manager over there. And they, Darby Dan would always lease other farms, and so they put me at different spots, and I got to sort of run the crew and have the vet come out, and I was the one doing all the charts and stuff like that. So it was a great experience. It was great. I sometimes I miss the farm. It's nice to get that day off. The pace is a lot slower. You know, when you're prepping yearlings, that's the busiest time of year. You know, it only happens for about 2 or 3 months. Where here at the racetrack, it's an everyday thing. You know, and the pressures of entering horses and races not going and things like that. It's sometimes I miss the farm, but I'm happy to be where I'm at now.
Well, it's such great experience for a horse trainer to have, to know about the reproductive facets of the horse, and to have all of those little opportunities to learn things from basically the ground up, starting out with a young horse. And what a meteoric rise to stardom. How was your heart pumping when that board was running up to 900,000?
It was, to be honest with you. I was just so nervous. I kind of walked out of there and I was sort of in shock. That was a whole lot of money for a 13-year-old.
Yeah, really.
I wish it was mine.
Yeah.
I wish I owned her.
Yeah, I'm sure you got a huge tip, right?
Oh, yeah. I was begging my dad for a dog, and I wanted a lab. So I spent all that money, and I bought a yellow lab from Minnesota and named her Chris after Chris S.
That's great.
So I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, the pedigree side of things is something that, you know, most trainers have a very good idea about pedigrees. And they, you know, but being able to look at a sale catalog and value a horse and things like that, and knowing what kind of filly you could claim and put her in a sale, I think all of those things are, having learned that from an early age, you know, you hear a lot of these race trackers, they grew up with a racing form in their hand. I grew up with a stallion directory in my hand and a sale book, you know, so I've got a pretty good idea of what I'm looking at. And that's going to be to my advantage later on too.
No, you have to be really proud with the experience you've had. I know myself, working for my brother, it was they didn't have child labor laws back then. I rubbed five a day for 3 straight years, no days off for my brother on the racetrack. But I tell you what, I'm so personally proud, as you should be, with your experience that, you know, I was joking, it's kind of true. I said, if you want to be a bloodstock agent, you just get on vistaprint.com and print out a business card with your name on it, put bloodstock agent, and you're in. I mean, there's no rules for it. So, you know, there's a lot of people out there that hold these positions, trainer, what have you, bloodstock agent. But to have the experience behind you, it does mean a lot, I think, and it really does pay off.
I agree. It's been nice. You know, growing up, I came to Keeneland, you know, every meet, and I was here every – I usually try to cut out of school a little bit early on Friday, and I'd be there all day Saturday and all day Sunday. And it's really cool coming back here and having my sign hanging up outside the barn and being able to stand on the rail and have a reason to be here. I think that's really cool, and I am proud.
Yeah,
and I hope my parents are too.
Yeah, know you belong. That's the feeling, knowing you belong.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, you you worked for Timbertown Stable, your dad's, I guess it's like a farm. It's a sales prep and consignment and all that. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I guess it's got to be maybe 8 years ago now. Dad left Darby Dan, maybe more. He left Darby Dan, and the backside of the farm, the farm's on Lees, Darby Dan's on Leestown Road. Out the back of the farm is the town branch, the creek that runs into the city. And right across the creek was 40 acres that they bought maybe 15 years ago and built it up slowly. Just, you know, it took a long time to get rolling. They built the barn. They built some paddocks, things like that. So that was the original Timbertown. And Kathy, my stepmother, would do layups there. She would do a lot of quarantine. And she might break a handful every year. And then so when Dad left Darby Dan, it made sense. You just keep the name going. And they bought, the farm was called Glencoe, which is just down, it's right next to Hillendale. And it's 150 acres there, and the little farm's 40. And they lease a couple other farms out around town. But it's a full-blown farm. They think they might foal out close to 75 mares. And they'll sell maybe 30 yearlings in September at Keeneland. They'll probably take a handful up to Saratoga, the better ones. Luckily, he's had a really good relationship with people like Mandy Pope and Shell Evans, who they're the majority. They own most of the mares on the farm. And so it's nice that, you know, of course, Mandy keeps a lot and so does Shell, but they'll always pick a handful of them out to sell. So they don't do much breaking anymore. They break a couple every year. Kathy just does it because she likes to. And they'll do layups and things like that. And so it's rocking and rolling this time of year. They're cutting grass and foaling mares and making breeding shed runs and things like that. So it's rolling along now. So yeah, it's been good for him to be able to sort of start back up on his own. And after, like I said, 8 years, he's kicking now. So it's awesome.
Well, it's nice to have those kind of clients, and maybe they'll find a horse for the new trainer in town, huh? That would be pretty good.
I have one for Mandy now. It was Fightstown Colt for her that she gave me right away. Jimmy Jerkins gave me 2 stalls at Palmettos this winter, and so I have a horse for my dad, and then I have the Fightstown Colt of Mandy's. And so it's been really cool. I've always, I've dreamt about training a horse for Mandy. That's something that I've always wanted to do. And so now I've got the opportunity to, and hopefully he can win some races for us.
What got you hooked on the sport of racing?
It's funny. We went to my parents. Darby Dan used to get a bus. Every year they'd take a big bus from the main house at Darby Dan, and they'd take all their clients and friends up to the Derby. So when I was, I was probably 13 or 14, and I stood up on this little podium. They had dinner the night before Derby, and they made me run through the list of horses, because most of those people there don't really follow racing like, I would. So I got up there and kind of just gave a real quick tutorial on how to read a form and things like that. And so anyway, I ended up picking the winner of the Derby, a couple other races on the undercard. And so I'm up there, we're on the fourth floor or something for Derby. And my stepmom and I are sitting out there watching these horses, in the post parade. And I said, God, I'd love to train a horse like this one day. And she looked at me and she said, you want to own a horse like this one of these days? And I said, well, yeah, that too. And so it's funny that I went back to the farm and I did most of the farm stuff growing up and never really got much exposure to the racetrack. And so I was building fence on the farm. When we moved on to Timbertown, they had a lot of those cherry trees. And they said we had to cut all those cherry trees down for the mares, for the reproductive, all that kind of stuff. So we were cutting down trees, and Christoph Clement came by to look at a couple horses on the farm. And he asked me what I was doing for the winter. And I said, well, I'm going to be here doing this. And he said, why don't you come down to Payson Park for a couple months and just get a taste of the racetrack so you can add that to your resume? I said, great, no problem. So I did that, and I stayed there for 3 months. And then after we left Payson, he said, you want to come to Saratoga? I said, yeah, I'd love to. So that lasted another 6 months. And so next thing I know, I've been with Christoph for a year. And I still wasn't dead set on doing the racetrack thing. I liked the farm so much. And I love the mares and foals. I love selling yearlings. So that was, I got a real buzz out of that. So then he said, well, before you go back, you better make one more stop out in California. Go spend a year or so in California. So he hooked me up with Owen Hardy. And so I went out there for 3 years. We were stable at Hollywood, which was absolutely fantastic. I loved Hollywood Park. And so I did that, and then 1 year turned into 2, turned into 3, and then by that time, it was great because Owen had a split string. He had a string in Tampa or Arlington or Keeneland, and the string in California kind of, it always stayed out there, never moved. So Owen did a lot of traveling, which gave me an opportunity to enter horses, to saddle myself, to talk to the jocks and the jocks' agents and talk to the owners. And I think that the first year out there, I think, was when I really thought to myself, I'd like to give this a try. And knowing that it would be a whole lot more difficult doing that than it would just to retreat back to the farm and fall right in as an assistant manager or whatever I'm going to be and have a truck and my phone paid for and all that, have a house on the farm. And I started bouncing the idea around, and then about the second year I was there, Hollywood shut down, and we had to move to Santa Anita, which isn't the worst place to train in the world. Believe me, it's great to train there. But I loved Hollywood Park, and so I started thinking to myself I might want to come back to the East Coast. And that was when Jimmy Jerkin's wife, Shirley, great lady, she is good friends with my stepmom, Kathy. So Kathy said, you know what? Jimmy Jerkins just had a really good meetup in Saratoga. Why don't you see if he didn't need somebody to help him up there? And being an assistant for Owen, I was left on my own. I could make a lot of decisions. I got to do a lot of things on my own. And one thing about Jimmy knows everything about every horse he's got in his barn. There's nothing left to chance, and he wants to be the one that makes all the decisions, which is great. I respect that. So going into his barn, I had to take a step back and just watch and learn, which I think was probably the best decision I made, was to come work for Jimmy. It's just the way he does things, the way his dad used to do things. Every decision he made, he would think about it for a second and think to himself, what would my dad do? Or what happened? We used to do this back in the day. We'll try this. And I think for me, it was humbling because I thought I knew it. I thought I could do it all. And I thought I knew that this was the right way, because this is the way that Christoph and Owen had done it. And then you go throw Jimmy Jerkins' way in there, and a lot of times it was completely backward from what you would have learned anywhere else. So it was great. It really was. So that was the year that he ran first and second in the Traverse with V.E. Day and Wicked Strong. And so I jumped right in at Belmont when Saratoga Finish came back to Belmont, and we had this New York bred in the barn that was just kind of a horse, but he was real pretty and had a good way of going and had a great mind on him, and his name was FNX. So slowly FNX got better and better and better as Jimmy got training on him, and so he turned out to be a great horse all those next two and a half years. And it was great. I got to go. I went to Santa Anita with him. That was the time he had Hives out there for the Santa Anita Handicap, by the way. And then we went to Oaklawn Park and went to Kentucky a couple times. So it was good exposure to get. I did all these things on my own with the owner. The owner and I would just travel together, and we would, you know, run the whole show, which was great. And that was good exposure to go to different racetracks and meet different people and see, you know, talk to the racing secretaries everywhere I went. It was great. So I really can't say enough about Jimmy as a trainer and as a person. He was a heck of a mentor, and he's a serious horseman, and he's got a serious group of horses in that barn right now.
Yeah, he really does. He's got a really nice barn, and he's such a great trainer. I want to talk to you in depth about those guys in the second half of the show, but there's a lot of people that want to train horses, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I used to say I'm going to write a book. So you want to be a trainer. I mean, every owner wants to be a trainer, right? They want to tell you what to do and where to run them and what time you should work them and all that. So it's not the easiest thing in the world, though, to get a trainer's license. In 2017, I'm out of touch a little bit because I got my trainer's license back in 1980. What do you have to do now in 2017 to get a trainer's license? Walk us through that process.
Well, I got my assistant's license out in California at Hollywood, and it was they gave me a 100-question exam. Granted, it was all multiple choice, but you would have thought I was taking a test for stewards. They asked me how much a whip weighs. They wanted to know what gets included in weight allowances and things like that. And so that was pretty tricky. So I got that done out there, and then I kind of just figured, well, I'll have this for a long time, and then by the time I get my trainer's license, I'll just breeze right through it. So I come down, I took the test at Gulfstream, and first, before they do that, they want you to do what they call a barn test, where you go into somebody's barn and you tack up a racehorse and you put, you know, that wrap on its legs and you put the saddle on the bridle and this, that, and the other. And they kind of quiz you about some sort of basic things that if you had worked in, especially a barn like Jimmy Jerkins, I tacked up thousands of horses in Jimmy Jerkins' barn just to help out, because that was sort of the way that we did it. It was always boom, boom, boom. You were in a rush. These guys had about 15, 20 minutes to get the horse ready, and that was it. So I did it. I can tack a horse up with my eyes closed. So did that, no problem. And then they wanted me to come up to the stewards in Gulfstream and take basically the same type of exam that was out in California. Straightforward, not trying to trick you or anything, but there were some questions that you really needed to know the condition book. That was one thing they said, you have to read the condition book. And working for Christoph, that was something he drilled into me, was you must know the condition book. You must know where to place your horses. And so that, it was no problem, but it was. You know, you walk in there, and especially timing-wise, we were getting ready to leave Palmettos, and I was going to ship to Keeneland, and I was going to enter my filly on a Thursday for Sunday. So I was going to arrive in Kentucky on Tuesday, enter the filly on Thursday to run on Sunday. So I was under some serious pressure to get this license done, and I got pretty nervous in there. But anyway, had no problems getting it, passed it, no problem. And then I get up here, and once you have your trainer's license, as you both know, that trainer's license is good anywhere you go around the country, similar to an assistant's license. You can go to Oaklawn, to Arkansas, to anywhere you want to go, and that assistance license is valid, and they'll give you one from their jurisdiction. And so I walked right into Kentucky with my trainer's license from Gulfstream, and they were happy to give me a license. So I Believe me, I was happy to get it too.
In case you tuned in late, this is Jude Feld, and we're visiting with trainer Kent Sweezy on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Well, I got my trainer's license at Hollywood Park as well, and I was so nervous. I was at Bobby Frankel's barn in the morning. I was working for Julio Canani, and then Julio went home, and I went to Bobby's barn and hung out with Humberto Escaño, Bobby's assistant, and I was a wreck. And I was also working for the Racing Form at the time, so I went over to the press box, and in those days they had a free-flowing keg of beer. So I had two beers, which is totally out of character
just to
for
stop
me.
Just to
relax. I mean, I was like wound up like an 8-day clock, and that I had the two beers, and I kind of settled down, and then I was looking for gum because I didn't want to go in there smelling like a brewery. and I went in those days. You had to meet with the stewards, and they ask you the questions. There was usually two stewards and one trainer there, and it was an oral test. Yeah, it was pretty nerve-wracking, and I knew the stuff. I think I missed one question or something, but they said, oh, you're very well prepared, and we know you've been working towards this and everything. It was nice because I actually had a relationship with the stewards, and it went relatively fast, and I got it, and boy was I relieved, because that was about as nervous as I've ever been, because I'm a pretty laid back guy. Well, you know my brother, we're kind of the same way, and I know
the feeling. Yeah,
yeah, and it was just
when you were 16 taking a driver's license test, and you had to parallel park the car with the guy sitting next to you.
Yeah,
you know, and it's nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I flunked that the first time. Maybe that's why I was nervous for the trainer's test.
It's because he didn't have two beers before the driver's test. That's why.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Yeah. Well, I know it's changed quite a bit, and I know it also varies from state to state, like everything else in our business.
Unfortunately,
some people give written tests, some people give oral tests. I think the main thing is the practical test now is very important. I think, you know, a lot of times there's people that they might know the book stuff, they might be able to study up on the medication rules and all of that, but you ask them to
put
a saddle on.
Never put a rundown bandage on.
Exactly.
Never tack the horse up. Yeah, you're right about that. You're right.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. I mean, I think a lot of trainers go from handicapping to training. There's quite a few nowadays that never really grew up with horses or touched horses much, you know. And then it is a game of tactics and speed figures. And, you know, if you can read the condition book and handicap, it does help your training a lot. But as far as the horsemanship's concerned, it's a new world.
It is indeed.
Yeah, well, that's what makes you kind of unique and stand out amongst young trainers, is that you have that background, and you're not just a guy that reads the magazine sheets well. You know everything there is about a horse. You foaled mares, so you can take them from birth to
the
Kentucky
circle.
Derby. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, I mean that's outstanding, and like Bob said, it's kind of unheard of in these days.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. A lot of when I was working for Christoph, he drilled in. You have to use a number. You know, you either have to really know the buyers, but the buyers are somewhat getting outdated, really. But nowadays, you get, like you said, Bob, earlier about the bloodstock agents, that anybody can just buy the rag sheets and find the best horse. And if you've got a guy with some money, well, you're going to buy that horse. You know, and so you have to be familiar when these guys shoot off a number that it ran such and such, or it did this or did that. You need to know what that means, because that's how you're going to get the horse in your barn. And it's really important. And I, as everybody did, we all grew up with the buyer numbers. That was just the number that we all could sort of gauge from. And nowadays there's so much more information. Technology's really, really changed the game on the buying and selling aspect of it, knowing where to place your horses.
Some of us grew up with speed ratings, which the older folks out there, that's all we had. I mean, the buyer numbers were huge versus the speed ratings. But it's a lethal combination. You have the horsemanship and you can read the numbers. I mean, that's, you know, Frankel, I think, really brought numbers to the forefront of placing his horses. Chad Brown, obviously, chip off the old block, uses them. I always say Charlie Whittingham, who I consider the best trainer that ever lived, only because he had the sheets in his brain before the sheets came out. Horses would never bounce on him. He'd kind of give him one going into the big race, and he'd lose the prep and win the grade one. So
that's a Jimmy Jerkins thing.
Yeah, they understood sheets before the sheets came out. But it's a lethal combination if you have the horsemanship and the knowledge of the sheets and the speed figures.
Exactly.
Yeah, the old school guys were really special, and I always feel very fortunate to have been around them and learned from them. And you know, Bob and I, we used to cut out all of Charlie Whittingham's winners and paste them in a book, and we used to study his training patterns. And of course, what we didn't realize was he had the best horses in the country. So when we opened our stable and started training, we had quite possibly the worst horses in the country, and you couldn't exactly train them the same way. But we were always ready, and when we finally did get a horse that could run, we won a grade three with him. Bob picked him out, claimed him for $20,000, and we won a grade three at Santa Anita with him.
Oh,
and
nice.
That was a big deal for us, because I remember one morning after we got him, we worked him, and he worked 58-2, and Bob and I looked at one another and we said, this horse can really run. And we didn't screw him up, so that was a good thing.
Yeah, it is. That's something that like you said, about if you don't have you have to have the horses to train like these guys do. You know, and Jimmy has a way of getting the best out of a horse and knowing if they have that foundation under him. If he's had them all along, you know, Jimmy had no problem stopping on one. You know, he would be really quick to turn one out because he knew it had some talent and didn't want to screw him up. And so, you know, for example, getting a horse in from somebody that came off the farm from an injury or something, and I'm getting it, and I probably won't be able just right off the bat to just jump right in and work them up to that 5/8, and then think, okay, well, I want to give them a nice long work. You know, you have to know which horses you can do that to, and know how hard you can push on certain ones. And I think as long as they've got that foundation, that base, then you get an idea how hard you can push them.
Well, I think that's one of the benefits too of having a young trainer who doesn't have 300 head of horses. You know, is
sure.
that personal attention. When I started out, I won 5 out of my first 7 because it was just me and the horse, you know, and that was a good thing. And I think, you know, when you get a lot of horses right away and you've got all the pressure of payroll and personalities and all of that stuff, it really puts you behind the eight ball. So if you can stay small for a while, get your legs under you, so to speak, it's going to be to your benefit.
Yeah. I'm hoping I can, I've got 5 now. And I hope to get a couple starts in here at Keeneland, and then we've got a couple that are lined up for the first few weeks at Churchill. But like you said, you know, I'm going to have to – I know exactly how much every horse eats because I'm the one pulling their feet up, and I'm the one putting it in. And coming back at night was something I learned from Jimmy Jerkins. You come back and you just watch your horses at night, and you know what they're eating and how they're doing and how they're standing in the stall, if they lay down, what their manure looks like, all that kind of stuff that – like you said, if I jump right in with 30 horses, I'm going to have to be hiring people, and it's just not going to be, you know, it's not going to go as good as it would if I'm just starting out with a handful and can inch my way up there, you know.
Yeah, it's good philosophy. You got to walk before you can run. And we're really enjoying this interview with trainer Kent Sweezy, and we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Nominate your yearlings now to the Fasig Tipton Summer Selected Yearling Sales. These sales are the top 3 yearling sales in North America by rate of return. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky, July 10th and 11th. The Saratoga sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 7th and 8th. And the New York bread sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 12th and 13th. Selected sales, superior results. Nominate today at FasigTipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at BloomRacing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Ross Amaya, what a finish to the contest.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN, presented by Fasig Tipton.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. This is Jude Feld, and I want to remind you that if you missed any portion of this show, it will be archived on our website, horseracingradio.net, and is also available at Horse Racing Radio on iTunes. So, in the first part of the show, we talked about some of the guys that you worked for, Kent, and we're here with Kent Sweezy on Trainer Talk. You started out with Owen Hardy. Talk about Owen, his training style, and what you learned from him.
Well, first I started with Christoph. That was the, the first guy I worked for. And Christoph is an organizer. He knows his shed row is immaculate. His office has all the charts, the shoeing charts, the vaccinations. Everything is put together to a T. And one thing about Christoph, he has a knack with these fillies, and I think he might not like it, but he is. He's a really good trainer of fillies going long on the grass. That's where he's won most of his races. And he does. He's patient with them, and when these horses come over from Europe, he gets a lot of the European fillies, and it takes him a while to get used to American style of training and the feeding that we do here, and he has just, he's perfected it. And he had great riders and still does have great riders and good assistants. And when he would get one in, you would look at it and think, God, this thing, there's no way this thing can be any good. And he just kept saying, it'll come around, it'll come around. And the beauty of being at Payson Park was that he could use that turf course, and it wasn't, he could individualize to where if one needed to go, you know, gallop long on the grass, he'd let him go out there, and they would just kind of do a two-minute lick and things like that. And then they'd start coming around, they'd start eating better, looking better. And he was great in that way. And he's a really good teacher. He likes young people. Christoph's he's a great mentor. And so starting out the racetrack, not knowing, I couldn't really put a saddle on when I first started for Christoph. And so I jumped right in there, and he said, don't worry, just be patient. He hooked me up with a foreman, and I kind of shadowed that foreman for the first couple of weeks. And once I got the hang of it, he gave me my own barn across the street. And so I ran that. And none of the trainers I've worked for have been very big medicators, you know, and that's something that Christoph was pretty strict about, was knowing what meds certain horses were on and keeping the schedules and keeping the routine and things like that. And so he was it was a good stepping stone. It was a good start for me. And then when I went to California, like I said earlier, Owen wasn't there a lot. He was on the East Coast. He had maybe 20 horses in California, but he probably had 30 on the East Coast. And so he would bounce back and forth. But it was great for me to learn. Owen trains the Bob Baffert way, you know, where you're pushing on these two-year-olds. You need early two-year-olds. And a lot of the horses that he bought from the sale would be early type of horses. So it was good to see how Christoph didn't like to push horses. You know, they came around at their own time. And with Owen, he bought these horses specifically to be early two-year-olds. So it was good to see how, you know, horses are getting shins and what you're going to do for shins and things like that. And then once you get that horse, then you know, he knew exactly how to turn him into a decent three-year-old. And we had a couple good three-year-olds out there when I was there. And it was interesting to see how he could develop one from a two-year-old year into Del Mar and then back up and how they turned out to be as three, which was really good. And so, again, it gave me experience in being able to talk to the agents and knowing how to use an agent and how you can benefit from having a good relationship with one or a couple of them. And that was great. I kind of got to do a lot of things on my own. And I think Owen was the first one to tell me it's going to be baptism by fire. He said, you're just going to get thrown right into it and sink or swim. And I think it was great. I really enjoyed it out in California, but I was glad to be back on the East Coast when I came back.
Yeah, well, it's a whole different kettle of fish, so to speak. The way that people train horses in California, with an emphasis on speed and back here, it seems like you can maybe not work a horse as many times or as long as you do when you're in California. I mean, in California, you really have to have those horses fit because they're running at such a fast pace. And, right. And that's why California speed is so dangerous when it comes back east.
Definitely.
But yeah, that's an interesting contrast. You know, Kristoff, he does have the reputation of the Phillies on the turf and stuff. But if you look at his stats, the guy can train anything. He's a fantastic 2-year-old trainer, which a lot of people don't know. I use that to my benefit at Saratoga. So
I think it was last year or the year before, he rattled off a bunch of wins up there with 2-year-olds.
Yeah, yeah. He did very well last summer. And, you know, he's a guy that can – he could train anything, short, long, dirt, turf. I mean, he's just a really well-rounded trainer. And I was interested –
Well, the horses he had in the Breeders' Cup a few years ago, he had Tonalist in the Classic. I think he had Pure Sensation in the Turf Sprint. He had about 3 or 4 of them. They were all different type of horses, which credit to him, like you said. I know he has a reputation of being long on the grass with fillies, but he sure can train anything.
Yeah, yeah, he's amazing. And I thought it was interesting, too, that his main tip to you was to read the condition book. Because you think of Kristoff Clément and you think, well, you know, he runs mostly in stakes and allowance races, so there's not really...
Those are easy to pick.
Yeah, like a lot of choices. You know what's available, mm-hmm. and you decide to run or not to run. It's not like you're a claiming horse trainer and you're trying to find a condition or a spot that might be easy. But that's what a well-rounded horseman he is. And Owen and I, we've been friends a long time, and I love Owen, and I know he has the Baffert influence. A lot of the guys that work for Baffert, they love the young horses and hopefully, mm-hmm. you know, turn them into good 3-year-olds. And that's a philosophy, and they take after them in that regard. And then your last trainer was Jimmy Jerkins. And I was reading a little bit about you and about Jimmy Jerkins. And you got a great shout out from Adina Springs about Shaman Ghost winning the Santa Anita Handicap. That was pretty cool.
It was. We actually had about 5 runners while we were back at Palmetto's when Jimmy went out with Shaman Ghost. And in typical Jimmy Jerkins fashion, first he says, I'm going. Then he says, no, you stay. Then he wanted to go. Then he changed his mind again and changed his mind again. But I ended up staying back here. But it was nice to see. That horse rattled off some pretty strong races, from winning the Woodward to going down and running third in the Clark behind Gunrunner, then second in the Pegasus, and then he went out and really hit that good grade one and in the big cap. And Mike Doyle from Adina has been really great. The advice that he'll give me and tips and pointers here and there, and it's nice to know a guy who's a racing manager, but he also trains himself, so he knows exactly how hard it is to get started, to get horses, how to juggle everything, and he's been great too. And Jimmy's really picked up some good horses from Adina the last 2 years.
Yeah, well, it's really nice to see. I mean, he's such a talented guy and such a thoughtful man, the way that he trains his horses. You were there for a lot of these good horses. Let's talk about some of them, like Wicked Strong, one of my favorites.
Mine too, really. He had some quirks to him. He was a cool horse to be around, but he was tough. You know, he trained strong, and I remember one day before the Jockey Club at Belmont, it was raining, and Jimmy said, "Oh God, he's got to go out and do something." So I took him with the pony and the rider on the horse, and we jogged him the right way, and it was sloppy and wet, and these horses are breezing past him, and that was his. I had my hands full that day. And he propped and dropped the rider and slung the chain out of my hand. So he's loose right in front of the clocker stand at the training track, and he just stands there and just waits for me to grab him. I jump off the pony, rush over to him, and grab him. But he was a handful. I have a great picture of him rearing up with me down there on the Rice Road Barns for Breeders' Cup week when he ran in the dirt mile. I think he ran fourth in the dirt mile. Talk about a horse that had all the talent in the world. He just sort of ran into some really good horses. He ran fourth in the Derby. He ran fourth in the Belmont, fourth in a couple grade ones up in Saratoga, fourth in the Breeders' Cup. So he was right there. And from what everybody says, he's had some nice foals, so hopefully they can run like he did.
Yeah, he was a cool horse. I always liked him. He didn't have the best of luck sometimes, but he was a runner. You mentioned earlier FNX, quite possibly one of the greatest horse names ever.
Only if you're a divorce guy.
He's out of a mare called What a Pair. So that just the whole that guy Russell Cohen, he can name him.
Yeah, he's a nice horse too. He won a lot of big races for you guys. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well,
sorry, I lost you there.
No. What about Unified? He had a tough beat Unified. The other day.
He sure did. I think he usually pops out of the gate and he sticks his head out there before anybody else does. And I think he broke just a half step slow, and Castellano tried to rate him a little bit. I kind of wish he had just sent him up there. And he's super fit, you know. So when he beat Mind Your Biscuits down in the Gulfstream Sprint Stake that day, we were worried that he wasn't going to be fit to go six right away, right off the bat. And he was just held on. So stretching out to seven shouldn't have been any problem at all. And that horse is a good horse that beat him up there. He's an aqueduct specialist. And I was texting with Jimmy after the race, and he said he didn't quite think that he was going to be the horse to beat us, but he was sure going to compromise our going out there with an easy lead. So, and that's what happened. But he is he's a seriously fast horse, and he showed it last year. You know, he stretched out from broke his maiden at six. He won the Bayshore going seven. He won the Peter Pan going a mile and eight. And all those times when he runs with a loose rein out there on the lead, he's really, really tough to beat. And I'm sure he'll come back and he'll catch a grade one for sure before it's all said and done. Probably a couple of them.
Yeah, he's got a lot of talent, so we have him to look forward to. When you're out acquiring horses, do you like to go to sales?
I obviously grew up going to the sales, so I know the ins and outs of everything. I went down to the Miami sale that they had at Gulfstream, and it was tough. I didn't really have much time to go to all the Ocala sales last year like I would have liked to because we were so busy in the barn. But it's something I'm going to have to make time to do. You know, it's going to be tricky because, like we talked about before, starting out with a handful, I'm doing a lot of things myself. You know, I'm right there. I'm tacking the horses up. I'm getting a bath and all that stuff. So I'll need to make time to do it. I'm hoping to go down to the OBS sale here in the next few weeks and try to just get out there and shake some hands. And there are lots of horses that don't meet their reserves, or they get bought up and they don't really know where they're going to send them yet. So if you put my face out there and I can shake some hands and meet people, hopefully I can pick a couple of them up.
Yeah. Now that you have your trainer's license out, do you have a game plan as far as, well, let's back up the club racing, which is myself, my son, and AJ Judy's partnership group. We are giving you 10% of our horse holdings. You know that, right? Disciplinary action.
I do. I'm very happy to say I'm a trainer for the club. I love that.
You train for the club now, and we really are happy to give you the horse. Hopefully he works out. He's gone through some setbacks here and there, some minor ones, but I think we have him lined out for you, and hopefully we can move forward. But what's your circuit going to be? You know, where is your home base going to be? What are you thinking right now initially when you start off?
Home base is going to be, as of now, it'll be Louisville. They gave me six stalls at what they used to call the Sports Spectrum, now is Trackside. And a lot of people train there. Mike Maker has a big string there. Joe Sharp, Brendan Walsh won a couple marathons from Trackside. But I'm working on getting some stalls at Churchill. I think being here at Keeneland for the last, say, 10 days, and I'll be here for the 3 weeks, it's great to go to the paddock and to show face and for people on the rail to see my saddle towel out there. And I've already picked up a couple horses just being here. And so I'd like to stay in Louisville. I probably won't be able to go to Saratoga this year. You know, you got to have the stock to go up there. But the purses at Ellis just got raised up. So that'll be – Ellis is a fine place to go for the summer and try to win some races there. And then I would like to think that I'll have some horses to go south with in the wintertime. Loved Palmettos. I did. I thought Palmettos was a great place to train and a great place to be. You just have to have the owners willing to go and the horses that can compete down there. And if not there, a place like Fairgrounds will be fine, obviously. The problem with Oaklawn is there's no grass, and I have a feeling I'm going to have some grass horses. So unless I can turn them out for the winter and just take some dirt horses down there, or horses that are coming off layoffs that aren't going to be running, those would be ideal to take down there and just get them ready. It's a good place to train. And then come back up here. And I think the purses up here are great. And it was tough in New York. You know, you're banging heads with Pletcher and Chad Brown and all the rest of them. Not that I'm not here, but at least when I go to Churchill, you won't have them in the entry box, which will be nice. And so we'll just go from there. But I think Louisville will be a great place to start. I have a lot of connections in Louisville. a lot of people that there's a syndicate group that my stepfather runs called Turf Stable, and they're going to send me a couple horses, and so I'm excited about that. It'll be good to get back. Louisville was home for a long time. I love Louisville. Louisville's grown up into a big city, and it's got lots going on. So I'm looking forward to being there.
If you just joined us, this is Jude Felden. We're visiting with trainer Kent Sweezy on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You mentioned your saddle towel. What does it look like? What can we look forward to when we're out there at Keeneland watching the horses go?
Stable colors, what are they?
They are blue, yellow, and white, and it's my initials, JKS. And my girlfriend, Brittany, who used to work for Brad Cox and Ron Moquette, a couple other people, she's my right and my left hand. So she gets on them in the mornings, and we tag team it when we get done.
Any story behind the color scheme?
Not really. I always liked them, and now that I've got them, I see so many people that have similar colors. Michael Matz and Christoph being one, and my main man Bob Baffert out there, he's the same color. So I like them. It works. It works. And I've always been a little partial to blue, so I like to keep the blue
yeah,
in there too.
The Fell family's big on silks and colors and patterns, and that's our thing. So
but I love your all silks. I think they're great.
Oh, thank you.
Barbados blue and gold, you can't go wrong.
Exactly.
So you're just getting started, and things are sounding like they're going really good. So what's your basic training philosophy? You've got all this great background from three varied but all talented trainers. Where does that put you? Where are you at right now?
I hate to say that there's one, there's definitely not one way to train a horse. And I think learning from Christoph with those grass horses that we had when I was there, like a Geoponte and Winchester, and he had some really good grass fillies too. It was, you don't have to work a grass horse as hard as you do a dirt horse. You can work them easy and let them come around to you. But again, like I said about working for Owen, these two-year-olds, they got to get pushed on a little bit, see if they're going to make it at two. And a lot of times owners will specifically buy a horse to make it a two-year-old, to be a two-year-old. So you do have to push on them a little bit. But at the same time, going back to Jimmy Jerkins, you got to know when to stop because you don't want to screw it up. People have paid a lot of money, and you hope that these owners have enough faith in your patience to, when you say it's time to stop and to do what's right and bring them back, try to make them a good three-year-old. Jimmy, we have horses in the barn. He stopped on two or three times, and they come back better than ever. And you then have a good older horse. And it's the way the game is that a lot of horses, they do get hurt and they're finished. So by the time that horse comes back around in its three-year-old year, granted, you might miss all the Derby preps and all that, but that's not the end all be all. I'd like to just have a horse that they can stick around, and I'd love to have some nice handicap horses like Jimmy's had over the years. I'd love some of those bigger races in New York, like the Jockey Club Gold Cup and the Woodward and things like that that are just, I love a good older horse, a hard knocking, true, honest older horse. And yeah. So I'm hoping I can have a couple of them.
Yeah, it's so nice when a horse has a career instead of just a meet.
A season,
Yeah, it's a great philosophy to have, I think, starting out, and it really helps your patience because, when you're first starting out, you want to do good and you want to run horses and all of that, but if you can take the long view and mm-hmm. just think about the horse and the horse's future the whole time you're training each and every horse, I think in the end, you're going to be a lot happier with the results.
Definitely, no question. No question.
So are you going to try and start a little yearling program? Or, as talking with two-year-olds, it is what people, I think a majority of the people want a two-year-old and obviously a three-year-old in the fall. So, or in the spring, should I say. But are there any plans of hitting the yearling sales, trying to start off a little program to at least have a couple new bullets in the holster every year going into the two-year-old races?
Yeah, that's something too. I have most of the horses that I've got now, I'm getting for breeders. And so this is the time of year that two-year-olds come in. And so I've had some people that are going to send me some two-year-olds that they've bred and raised. But like you said, I've got to get some bullets coming every year. and not to mention some that I can run it to, hopefully, and hopefully have a big horse by the time this time next year, you know. And I got some guys that are going to go to the Timonium sale, so I'll probably go there to the Phasic sale up there. And like I said, I'm going to really try to get down there to OBS for at least a couple days, just to see, you know, see some people and talk to everybody and see if I can't round up a couple more.
So if you were going to talk about yourself for a minute, why should an owner take a shot with Kent Sweezy?
Tough question.
That's what we're here for.
I think integrity, really, and it's important that you're honest and you're fair, and the communication, I think, nowadays is so much more important as it, say, would have been 10 years ago, whether it's through email or through text. These people want to know, you know, they want to know what's going on. They're paying your day rate. They want to know. And the competition is really tough out there, because you have trainers that have assistants and you have secretaries that are going to be writing these emails, and they can inform what's going on there. But to be able to pick up the phone and call your trainer direct, I think, and be able to know what they're saying is not only true, but also that they're seeing it every day, you know. And like we talked about before, from a horsemanship standpoint, I've done a lot of things. And I think that's just the communication thing's really important. And knowing my horses and knowing when I can have to stop on one and doing the right thing by them all the time, I think that's important. And just the hard work and dedication that I put into it, that hope it pays off in the races when the races come around.
Yeah, I don't know if trainers take a half hour of their morning to text, but I love texting just as an owner. as far as the club horse is concerned, I think it's so easy to take 15 seconds to say, hey, the horse galloped out great, or he cooled out, he looks good this morning after a workout, just something simple. And I feel like I'm very informed on it with just a simple text.
Sure. And I think people want to have fun. You know, not many people are in this game to make money. It's not the game to do that in, not the business to do it in. So they want to have fun. You know, they want to know what their horses are up to, and you have to know what people want. If somebody wants to get a picture every couple of days or a little video, you got to be willing to do that. I've went out and I bought myself a pair of those video binoculars. Excuse me. The video binoculars that I think a lot of people are sending out videos of works and things like that. And as a fan starting out and working on the farm, seeing your horse out there breezing when you can't make it, if you live out of town or you live in a different country, I mean, how cool would it be to get a nice video of your horse? It's an up-close video and done the right way, and then you can come back and tell them how they cooled out and that kind of stuff, and if you scoped them and all that jazz. So
yeah, it's definitely a big part of the game now.
Technology is it's changed it, yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool. And, you know, sometimes education, too. Educating owners is important because then it makes your life easier, you know?
Definitely.
I had a guy one time, I had to scratch his filly. It was going to be her first race because she got a fever, and so he calls me that night and he goes, "Jude, it's been bugging me the whole time." He goes, "How do you keep the filly from biting down on the thermometer?"
Oh no.
This guy was an engineer. He was a brilliant guy. But it was my favorite trainer question ever. How do you keep the filly from
under her tongue?
Yeah. So that was a classic, and everybody always laughs at that story, but I was so shocked coming from a guy that was so smart. I think he went to MIT or something. I don't know. But anyway, it's owner education is definitely important. Well, we're almost at the end of the show. It's hard to believe we've cruised by so fast here. We always like to end up by asking trainers what they like to do when they're not at the barn. So is there any hobbies or fun things you like to do? Keep it clean.
I like to nap. I like to take a nap at lunchtime. but I used to play a little bit of golf. I'm a big Kentucky basketball fan, so I like to keep up on all that. And I can't really say I have very many hobbies. I'm at the barn most of the day, and if I get to sneak away for an hour, I'll try to close my eyes for a little bit and come back and feed, and then come back at night and throw the night feed in. But I got a great girlfriend right now. Her name's Brittany, like I said earlier, and we'll go do some things. When we're in Florida, we'll go to the beach every couple, you know, a couple times in the afternoon and in the afternoons, and just go to a movie, something like that, something easy. And it's been great being back here in Lexington. The Timbertown farm's just 5 minutes away. My mom lives in Louisville, so it's been great catching up with everybody, and I love going to the races. I like just cruising around, going to the paddock, looking at horses in the paddock, and I'm not a big golfer anymore. I don't work out or anything. I like to get all my exercise in the morning, I guess.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of walking, and do you get on any of your own or just your girlfriend?
I don't. Brittany gets on everything. I always rode a pony everywhere I've gone, but the problem with having a small amount of horses is ponies are expensive to feed and take care of and get a stall for. So I would like to think I'll be able to get a pony here in the next year when I get a couple more stalls. And it's nice to be out there. You can see a lot from the rail, but you can see a whole lot more when you're out there on the pony.
Yeah.
And not to mention, it's always nice to be able to walk back and forth with your horses. So I'll probably try to pick one up here in the next year.
Cool. Well, that was a quick hour. Cool. Really want to thank you for taking the time. Kent,
thank you guys. It was great.
Oh, good. Glad you enjoyed it. Kent and all of our guests on Trainers Talk receive a gift courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. And a special thank you to HRN producer Lee Delapina for keeping us in line and on time, and to my brother Bob for co-hosting the show with me tonight. I also want to remind everyone to tune in to the Equine Forum, the show that launched our network, this and every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time on Sirius 219, XM 206, and streaming live on our website, horseracingradio.net. This is Jude Feld from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studios. Good night, everybody.